Our friend writer Colin Fleming, he's got not just one, not just two, but three books out right now. In reverse order of release, they are If You, brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, and Hope, his wonderful book on the 1951 film Scrooge, and Sam Cooke, Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. We're happy to welcome in writer and the lead vocalist for the indie band Ballsack Incident, Colin Fleming.
Of course, Gimbel, I have to grade you. You like to insert that conjunction in the title. No conjunction. Leave that out. No
and. Sorry. Oh, no and. No and. You know who has and, though? Amazon. Amazon threw an and in there.
Oh, really? That's still there?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I will I'll get that fixed. Thanks for letting me know. And yes, my band, right? Ballsack Incident. We're talking about that band, right?
Yes, yes.
I perform with. And people, you're allowed to say that. It could, like, technically be a sack full of balls. I was running stairs yesterday. People don't read the blog. And I was exposed. My sweatpants were ripped. And not just a little bit, but quite a lot. And so, thankfully, my boxers weren't. And I thus avoided a ball sack incident. Because, Kimball, you do not in life. There are exceptions. People don't have to, like, well, I had a good one once. There are frequently just only bad ball sack incidents. So if you're using that phrase, things have probably not gone super awesome.
I think you're absolutely right when it comes to that. Well, let's see. So much to talk about this afternoon. Let's begin with some classic radio from the series Escape. I really enjoyed the heck out of this early Sir Arthur Conan Doyle work, Ring of Thoth, all about an Egyptologist looking for the elixir of life. And then out of the blue in that shows up Jack Webb. It was awesome.
You liked it. Now, Conan Doyle, you know what, Kimball? I'm looking at Amazon and I'm not seeing the end. Do we have separate Amazons? Dueling Amazon?
We might. We might. We might.
Yes. So Conan Doyle, sort of like a literary controversy, I guess, was that obviously he's the inventor of Sherlock Holmes and the master of logical detection and deduction. And Conan Doyle got really into spiritualism. And spiritualism during the time of Doyle, it was a lot of quacks and mountebanks and charlatans and all that stuff, scamming people who were falling in love with this idea of reaching out to loved ones on the other side and stuff. So Doyle wrote a lot of dicey, dodgy fiction about this idea. Like he was a believer. He was really into this stuff. And he was controversial because of it. And it just sort of like dogged his reputation ever since. So he goes that route with this particular story and also taps into what was the then vogue for Egyptian stories, mummies and everything. So that's when you had people opening tombs and curses and all that jazz. So it becomes this escape radio play where this guy, there's some twists at the end that don't really work. It's like too many twists, perhaps, where this guy is at the museum and he manages to fall asleep and he wakes up after the museum's closed and there's this other guy who is, he's like the Boris Karloff character in 1932's The Mummy. He's come back and he wants to revive his lady friend and he has a way to do it and he sees the guy. He's like, huh. If I discovered you 15 minutes before, I would have knifed you with my mighty blade, but now I'll just sort of give you a whole backstory. So sit down for an earful. And he walks him through it.
All right, now I'm checking. Now I'm checking here, and Amazon has cleaned it up. I swear to you, earlier today there was an and in there. Now, maybe I had just seen it and just incorporated. Who knows? Look, I'm getting old. My faculties aren't what they used to be.
Well, the reason because I monitor it, and then it was wrong so many times.
Yeah.
Like going back a while. So I know that it had been right for a while, but they just, like, so many, I think the publisher got it wrong. It's like my team. And so I was always, like, correcting people on this, and it just, one more thing to grind me down, as my cardiologist says, but one less thing to deal with. And Yes, daggers and amulets and twists at the end, and not everyone is who they seem to be. I guess that's sort of like the way this works out at the end, but pretty solid, pretty different, I think. Escape is one of the radio, I'm just so versed in all of them now. I wish that the horror vintage old-time radio programs were better. A lot of times they're fun, but they're fairly laughable. I think that's why, like, a series such as Quiet Please, is the quality of it stands out from everything else. But Escape would have these, it was dependable. It was always like a B-plus kind of episode. It wasn't going to be silly. Even Suspense could be pretty silly, because the whole premise of Suspense was, we set you up this way, and you're never going to know what happens at the end. And in order to do that, you just need to get ropey. Like, didn't see that coming. And it's just like, all right, that's so far-fetched just to have that kicker, that surprise. But Escape is pretty faithful to the literary works and the production values. Like, it's just always solid. And also, people, it's a good one to go to sleep with at night, because that's what I do. I can't just sleep in darkness because I'm so, like, tormented by so many things. So I always have on these programs, and it's like, what's going to be the rotation for that particular week? But Escape is a pretty solid choice.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. A couple of musical selections to discuss next, starting with The Who, and a very different sounding Who performance from, I think, 1964, Baby Don't You Do It.
Yeah, this is rounded up on the Odds and Sods, the expanded version of the Odds and Sods compilation. I think this is just one of the most exciting pieces of music from the 1960s. And this is The Who when they were, it's like High Numbers, that was the name they had before they were The Who. They're still like in High Numbers territory. And they would play this song later in 1971, and then there are a few instances where they still perform it in 1972. In Europe, but it's pretty rare, and it was this cover of Marvin Gaye's song, and it was this opportunity for Keith Moon, the drummer, to really do his thing, and he is playing syncopated against Pete Townshend on guitar. So really, if you know it from The Who, you know it from 1971. There's an edited down live version that's one of the best B-sides in the history of rock and roll that came out in the early 70s. But this is something different. It's in the studio where we're not really used to hearing the song. And it's just this sonic anarchy. And so you have this enormous beat, this rhythm from Keith Moon. And then Townshend doing his thing on the guitar, comping away. But the guitar solo is just unlike anything that there had been in rock and roll up until that point. He's using so few notes. He's using distortion. He's using, like, reverb and echo. It sounds like almost like a political act of defiance in musical form. It's not, like, actually political, but it's just like this radical punk but very controlled just burst. I mean, when you hear it come through the speakers, it sounds futuristic. It doesn't sound like something from 1964. It's as shocking in its way as Hendrix must have been to people like Pete Townshend a few years later, or a couple years later, in 1966.
And then, okay, you're wearing me down slowly but surely here. I'm reversing course on live performance, and what you suggested for me to listen to this week went a long way, because this performance by the Grateful Dead from April of 1970. Wow. It's stunning is all I can use to describe it.
I was actually thinking about you with live performances, because I remember you'd mentioned a couple times that you think of live performances as like one guy does a long solo and the guy does another long solo. It's not really going anywhere. And the reason I was thinking about that was because I can't think of a single thing that fits that bill. And it made me think we've had different listening experiences to live stuff, because I just don't have that experience. If I was going to cite, oh yeah, like on that disc, I don't have one of those. And so this is it's tough not to have this appeal, I think, to a listener. Because even if a listener thinks, well, I don't want to hear these, like, 20-minute Grateful Dead songs, in which they never were, because if you even, like, during their stretch-out days and all of those years and everything, there are plenty of songs that are coming in at, like, 3 or 4 minutes or whatever it is. They're doing all kinds of things. They're really no different than going to hear the Count or the Duke Ellington band, like, in the 40s. And they're remarkably similar. But this is cool because it's a gig that's not really a gig. Like, they couldn't call themselves the Grateful Dead at the time because they had this engagement somewhere else, like, that week. So it's supposed to be, like, this Ron McNiernan show, and, like, he doesn't show up, and they're at the Family Dog out in California. And it's just this impromptu, it's like a pickup game where a couple of the guys of the Dead are there, like Bob Ware and Jerry Garcia, and Mickey Hart's there, and they're doing their thing, and then, like, Pigpen wanders in, and it's just such a contrast to, like, Ticketmaster and Surcharges and, like, Paul McCartney adding a second show at Fenway Park. It's like hanging out music. And what they're doing is they're mostly playing acoustic. So people think of the Dead as, like, Dark Star and Electric and all this stuff. And this is 1970. And we've talked about this year for the Dead because it's like their version of the Beatles 1963. They're doing all of these amazing diverse things, and they have the two albums that come out, which must have been, I mean, I wasn't around then, but it must have just been so shocking to people that you're going from Live Dead to Working Man's Dead and American Beauty. Like, you just, all of a sudden, you're like a different band. You're like this folk acoustic country band, and this is them sounding that way for over the course of the entire gig, but it's not even like a real gig, even though there's the music and you can listen to it. You know, it's a little bit like that way Elvis Presley and crew, Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins, the Million Dollar Session, right, around Christmas time, 1956, when Elvis comes by with Sun Records, and he's like, hey, and they just start playing together, they start jamming. And so I figured a guy like you would have a tough time not liking, for instance, the cover of the Everly Brothers' Wake Up Little Susie. I mean, how could one not like that? Like, what's there to object to?
Well, and we've talked about their musicianship and how underrated that's been, but I thought the most impressive part of this performance were the vocal harmonies that were just Beach Boys-like and then some.
These guys are just, they're just phenomenal singers. And it's like everything you hear about them, it's just a world of disinformation. Everything you hear about them runs counter to what they are. Like, it scares you off what you hear about them. And, like, it's so boring, and it's like hippie music, and you have to be on drugs and everything. And you know what? For all the talk about drugs that they're on, they never sound like they're on drugs, do they? Like, not only do they sound like they're lucid-headed, they sound almost like prickish in how professional they are.
Mm.
Like, for instance, at this set, you hear them, right? You notice that they keep saying, Bear, can you fix the sound? Can you turn up the vocals? That's Owsley Stanley. That's like the LSD master. And also their sound guy. And they're chewing him out, I mean, somewhat jokingly, but also not really, in front of everyone. And we talked about the outtakes from those two albums from 1970 and comparing that with, like, Beatles outtakes from Rubber Soul, like the Think for Yourself session, which I think is still on YouTube. And that they're just these perfectionists. And that's not how anyone writes about the Grateful Dead. I remember one time I wanted to do this book. I still want to do it on Joy Division. And people said, well, there's so many books on Joy Division. I just thought, well, they all suck. And they're all just disinformation. And they're like sort of these myopic, mopey, Ian Curtis depression biography type things, or there was one from his widow. There was no one who actually told you what was happening in the music. And people suck at that. They're terrible at that. I mean, obviously, the Dead go back to the mid-1960s and the Warlocks and everything. And everything I always read coming up as someone music mad, it was all wrong. It wasn't just a little bit wrong. It was like, whoa, that's 180. That's not what they are at all.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Let's talk some early television here. And season one, episode one of a series that was not intended to be a series originally. We're talking, of course, about the Honeymooners and the debut, an episode called TV or Not TV.
So it's 1955, and it's the first of the original so-called 39. I've been watching these again recently, and I'm taken aback, and I'm depressed over how funny they are and remain, and the quality compared to every single last thing I experience right now. Like, I watch this show and I think these people were talented. I mean, they're there because of talent. And right from this first episode, now they've done the sketches and skits and all that stuff, and they sort of knew what they were doing, but the ensemble hadn't come together. But it's 1955, so it was really early, as we think of it now, in like the TV age. Because a lot of these radio shows that we talk about, they're all going strong or starting in the mid-1950s. Mm-hmm. It was still like radio, like Gunsmoke. And for instance, old-time radio westerns don't really get going until the 1950s. Like, you won't find them in the 40s. That's the horror and all that stuff. So radio was still like what people were into. And so this is about Ralph wanting to get this TV. And of course, Nord and Artie is into TV, and they come up with some plan that's not going to be. I think Alice is just such a believable character, and she's probably my favorite character on the show. But Norton ends up coming over again and again and again, like some infant idiot man stooge, to watch this sci-fi program, and he's so into it. He has the helmet, and it was a real sci-fi program. It's like they weren't even making it up, and it's so tight, and the humor doesn't date. I mean, I'm not from 1934, so this is well before my time. Still a youngster, so it holds up impeccably,
and it holds up because of great writing. And great acting, because I don't know that there's ever been a network television sitcom that had a less impressive set than The Honeymooners.
Oh, I love the set, though.
I know. It works.
Because it's at the time, it's like what? Like a cold water flat. And it's threadbare, to say the least. Like, you only really see that, the room, like the kitchen.
Mm.
It's like a bedroom off to the side. And it's like there's just nothing in it. It's not even minimalist. It's less than minimalist. And so your focus, first of all, whenever I see people, for the most part, who have like nothing in their homes, I always think that they don't have interests, because they usually have like, they own like one book and like one DVD. And I think, like, what do you actually fill your time up with at night? And it's just like the phone and it's the computer. But this is obviously a different age, and Ralph is always a very blue-collar guy. And so he's not dumb per se, but he's blue collar. I think Alice is smarter, and Norden is smart because he's in some sort of like weird fester from Gunsmoke out of the forest type of smart. But like Festus was always the smartest one on Gunsmoke. He just always sounded like an idiot because he was like chewing on a piece of grass talking like he did. But that set makes you focus on these people. And their interaction, and the timing, and the Jackie Gleason. I watch and I just think, wow, this guy. I mean, he must have been a perfectionist too, but he's just so talented. I don't mean like in some classic old showbiz way that we don't have anymore. He's like talented timelessly. If you watch this now, I challenge anyone, if you're out there and you're 20. And you're somehow listening to this program right now, go watch this. All the episodes are on archive.org. Check them out for free.
That is a series that I had not seen before, and I watched the first episode and thought it was great. The Likely Lads, a British sitcom that began airing in 1964.
I thought I could trip you up with this one. It was one of those ones where I don't know if you're going to have previously seen it, like Horror of Party Beach, which you had seen.
Mm.
I thought you might have seen that one, but this one I really would have been surprised, because
hadn't seen it, hadn't heard of it.
It ran from 64 to 66, and then it came back again in the 70s in color. It was black and white at first. Came back again as Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads. And the Libertines, English band, really good band. First album came out 20 years ago. Their second album came out a couple years after that. It was a song called Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads. It's really good. And keeping with our working class theme, it's the north of England. And so it's like whatever it is, I don't know, Newcastle or Manchester or Liverpool, those sorts of places, like where the Beatles and the Animals and all of them were from. So not like posh, studenty London, but more like you worked in a factory. And these guys did that. They're two friends, two young guys. And their interest in life come down to like football and lager and the ladies. And really their friendship, too. So we're going to see them in this series, like is in their early 20s, and later we see them established as adults. But they come back from a holiday in Spain, and they go to the bar, and they're like sort of living up the memories of the glory time that probably wasn't like really that amazing. It's probably like pretty dismal and depressing, just more drinking in different bars in a different country, and like they are dealing with this woman or whatever. But really a lot of it is that kind of smart working class humor. And I would say like it's fairly sophisticated that way. Like it's not like you're just palling around with like these idiots. Like they're fully realized and they have their concerns and their petty sort of like insecurities and their bigger insecurities and things that they need assuaged and other things that they're more confident in. And it's one of those great series too for just hanging out. And I remember watching like someone talking about a film once, and I don't even remember what the film was, and they said there's just so much drama in the human face. And there really is. Like really there's nothing more dramatic in some ways than listening to two people talk to each other, depending upon what they're talking about. Like I wrote in the blog a while ago that people are plot. Ultimately, it's people and how they're going to interact with each other. And even if you think about the things you're so into that I think are terrible, like Game of Thrones and blah, 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 it's not like the dragons or whatever. People are still always just like into what people are doing in relation to each other. So it's a great series for that. Only a handful, it's like 10 episodes, survived because this was a time when stuff just got wiped. I mean, like Doctor Who got wiped, all that stuff. So we're fortunate to have this from, you could have been like watched this episode and then if you were friends with guys in The Who, they could have played you an acetate of that song we were talking about at the same time.
It was fun. It had a real Hard Day's Night feel to it. And I want to watch whatever's left. I want to see the other episodes.
Oh yeah, it does. Like it's a kind of a humor. I guess I would put it this way: Northern England. There's a humor from that time period where there's a fierce utility to the humor. It's not just to make you laugh or to make the people having the humor laugh. It's to keep going. It's to maybe brighten up a hard existence or a period in life that's not like so rosy, and you have the rain and the gray, and you are trying to cleave out these things to look forward to: the football match, the dart contest at the pub, that sort of thing. So I think it's a form of hopeful, helpful humor, and that's why but it's also a dry humor. I would say if you like someone like Bob Newhart in his first two series, especially the first one, it's in that vein. It's like in the Mr. Carlin type of dour humor, black humor, but not depressing black humor.
Right. I wanted to ask you about this before we let you go. Rob Manfred apparently made the announcement just a few moments ago that he'll be canceling the first two series of the Major League Baseball season. What are your thoughts on baseball's never-ending efforts to kill itself?
Well, I didn't even know that. It's not very surprising that things would be canceled. I would probably expect that more things will be canceled. But to me, it was like this sport, I wrote about it on the blog yesterday or today or whatever, they're not even trying to fix what needs the fixing. And I think that's the real issue, that like you have this, you might have seen it, where I was writing about how anyone who watches baseball at all for like a certain amount of time, not even a long period of time, you see like a smash up the middle and immediately think, okay, we've got a guy on first. Let's get something going here. But now when that ball gets rocketed past the pitcher, there's just this anticlimax because it goes to some dude standing behind the second base.
Right. Yeah, the third baseman who's standing back there.
It's like a wonder that anyone is able to hit 300. And then the old timers, I wish hit it the other way. He's throwing 101 miles per hour. He has three other pitches. And he's pitching you inside because the defense is positioned a certain way. You can't just, it's not 1947 where you're just a flamethrower when you're throwing 91 miles per hour and maybe you have one other pitch, like a curve, and you're out there the entire time. So there aren't like five specialists coming in. So that and the whole shift and the time, I was looking at it this way. If you're a pitcher, I feel like you should be out of breath. It should be like a cardio type of workout that you're moving that quickly, and you should have to be in a certain fitness, not stroll around, let your arm sort of recover. And those, to me, are the biggest issues because that stops it from being a sport. That stops it. That makes it where you have to have it be this all-or-nothing thing. Because what choice do you have if you're an offense other than try to get like three hits and have two of them be like a two-run homer and a three-run homer? So you watch a basketball game, you watch a hockey game, you know what you're in for. You know you're there for 2 hours and 25 minutes. These baseball games last forever, and even if you love baseball, who's going to be there for 3.5 hours every night?
Right, and I love baseball, but the days of me sitting and watching an entire game are gone. I'm up and moving around the house, and a lot of times it's go outside and listen to it on the radio while I'm taking a walk because I can't sit there and watch them go through those exhaustive exchanges and then the multiple pitching changes. And you're right, I think, put a clock on pitchers and make them speed up, and if they don't, hey, that's ball one.
It's so simple. And like, you have to be on the mound, I would say, on the rubber, getting the signs within 20 seconds of the ball coming like back to your glove. And so that you can still shake off signs, yeah, but you have to be there. You have to have started. And then when you play this way, it simply becomes about analytics. It becomes about numbers. And baseball ceases to be a sport. It ceases to have like a human component. We've talked about this before. The starting pitcher in baseball used to be the great Homeric athlete of all the sports, the man in the middle of the diamond who went out there on his own, who would be left to the Lions. And we're just, now it's like, well, you've gone through, you have a no-hitter, but you've gone through the lineup twice. So out you come. And we're robbed of like, wait, Homer's just going to leave? We don't even see what's going to happen. He's, oh, see you next week? Then why even like pay that guy so much? Oh, and then we just say wins don't matter. It's just baseball. Everyone thinks it's hockey, but baseball is actually my favorite sport. And I have no life. I have no friends. So I watch it because I'm lonely. But like, if I had a life, I wouldn't be watching these games. I just would be getting the scores later and hoping the Red Sox won.
There you go. Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Colin, thanks as always. And we'll visit with you again next Tuesday.
All right. Sounds good.